This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Sephora stores are everywhere you are, so just pop in when you need a brown lip to match your 90s playlist, a confidence boost before your interview, or a last-minute gift for mom's birthday. There's always a Sephora near you. Just pop in. Use our store locator to find your local Sephora or Sephora at Kohl's.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The European Championships with Football Social Daily.
There's just 2 days to go before Euro 2020 fever takes over the footballing world, and here at Football Social Daily, we're all set for a summer of action. Welcome along to the latest episode on the road to the competition. As it's Wednesday again, I'll be hosting once more. I'm Marley Anderson, if you didn't know already. And we'll be talking haircuts, managerial developments, transfer rumours, and probably a whole lot more if you've listened to anything that I've ever hosted before in the meantime. There's also a chance for your questions to be answered at the end of the podcast on our AQA section. So if there's anything burning a hole in your head in the coming week, just send us a message on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or via our personal emails, which you'll have to guess because no one's going to tell you them, because there's quite a few people who are angry with things that we've said over the years, so we won't give those away. Anyway, joining me today on the show is Niall Lacorn. How are you doing, Niall? Are you still enjoying this sun?
I am. Well, I was until last night. I just couldn't sleep. I was too hot.
It was one of them horrible muggy nights, wasn't it?
Yeah, couldn't settle, couldn't rest. I live opposite a pub as well, and obviously it's been quite quiet at around 11 midnight every evening, because obviously no one's been in the pub for months, and now obviously the pubs are open again, so kick out time has become a real thing in my life. So just as I was settling down and getting over the heat, the shouting and screaming started, but I'm not going to complain. It's nice to hear people out and enjoying themselves again.
Yeah, I think we've got to that point where a fan becomes like the most sought after thing in the world, and all of a sudden a rotary fan goes from like £15 to about £35 because everyone's trying to run around and get them. But also joining us today is Ian Brannan, classic Wednesday lineup with Ian as staple part of it. How are you doing today, Ian?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. And like Niall, I had a fairly decent night's sleep, as you ask. And no pubs near where I am. All good on the East Coast, nice and cool. But I do have...
Got that sea breeze.
Yeah, it is very welcome this week. I do have my UEFA Euro 2020 wall chart. So I feel like I'm fully keyed up. We've got all the venues, previous winners, top goal scorers from the past, and all the fixtures in your day-by-day guide.
I can hear it rustling around in the background there. I'm jealous.
That's what I need. I haven't got one yet. I don't know whether I thought I'd sort of grew out of it, you know, being 30 in 3 weeks' time. Then I thought, oh, I'd really love a wall chart, especially because we in this new house that I've moved into a couple of months ago, we're still waiting on a mirror to come for the chimney breast. I think, what can I put there? Because it looks a bit bare at the minute. What can I put there?
Charts.
And then I thought, oh, if I had a wall chart, I'd stick it there and just wind Kelly up for the next month or so.
It's the only way you can actually keep track of what's going on, because there's so much going on. You can't do that really on a website or an app. You need that physical thing in front of you so you can just look and have a full map of exactly where we're at.
100%. It's like it's a staple of football in sort of history, isn't it? You know, every 2 years for a month every summer, you've got something filled in. I remember used to have them on my walls as a kid, filling in. I think the 2002 World Cup when Miroslav Klose just scored goal after goal after goal. And it was just Germany winning, and then I think Brazil won it in the end, didn't they? But yeah, that's us all excited for the Euros, and you should be too as well, because from Monday we've got we're back up to daily podcasts. So I think we kick off the Euros on Friday. England's first game is on Sunday, that's the 13th of June, and then from the 14th of June, the day after, we'll be talking about the England game on the Monday's podcast, and then we'll be daily, so we'll be talking about all the games that happened the day before on the podcast. We'll all be trying to randomly keep up with all the games so we can talk about everything. I don't know who's going to cover the North Macedonia versus, you know, Slovakia group or whatever it is, but we'll soon find out. I think I might put myself over for that and watch Ezgian Alioski. Oh, maybe that could be one for you, Ian. He's a Leeds player, isn't he? So there you go. Sorry, Ian.
There's Alioski and there's Click in there as I think plays for Poland.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a lot going on. It's a busy start though, because you've got Wales on Saturday, England Sunday, Scotland Monday, and it's going to be all exciting. The magic of the cup.
Yeah. Well, we have got obviously long time listeners will know that we've got a couple of Scottish guys ready and waiting for the Euros. They've been waiting a lifetime to even qualify to get here. So JP and Callum will be joining us at some point next week to talk over the Tartan Army and see what's going on there. And probably not in best of moods when they get slapped 7-0 by Croatia on the opening game or whoever it is. But
Czech Republic for Scotland.
Oh, Czech Republic. Oh, that's a... Yeah. Well, they've had it.
But they are playing Croatia further into it. Yeah,
yeah. Right. Sorry, yeah, Czech Republic. I forgot about that. They've got history there as well with the Czechs, with the racism thing with Rangers. So that could be interesting. But anyway, we'll look forward to that next week, because we're going to have to focus on what's happened this week. It's been kind of quiet with everything, just the build up to the Euros. But what we do have is something which has been, in my opinion, blown massively out of proportion. I didn't expect this to get all the headlines it did, but basically, Phil Foden's had a haircut. And that is, I was watching I don't know if you guys watched the 10 o'clock news last night, but I was watching it. It made the 10 o'clock news, like the national news. It was like the fourth story in, Phil Foden's had his haircut. And if you've missed this somehow, just run through it. Phil Foden's had his haircut and dyed silver, and he looks a little bit like Gazza from 1996. Also looks a little bit like Eminem. And also, if you know who Judge Rinder is, he also looks a little bit like Judge Rinder. but yeah, it got me thinking. Niall, what is the worst haircut you've ever had?
Still got it.
I was hoping you'd say that.
I don't know, to be fair. I've always like over my life. I can't believe we're talking about haircuts on this podcast. Over my life, I've tended to like grow my hair long and then cut it short and then grow it long and cut it short. I don't know whether it's because I'm too lazy to have a haircut or whether I just prefer having longer hair. I just think it suits me better. I don't know about the worst haircut I've ever had, to be honest. I was looking at some photos of me when I was very young, so like when I was sort of a toddler, and I did have a classic bowl haircut.
Yes.
Proper 90s sort of flat fringe over the eyebrows sort of thing, so I guess that could go into the category of the worst haircut. But when you're that young, it doesn't really count, does it? I just can't believe, like you say, that it's made the 10 o'clock news.
Yeah.
Like, he's had a haircut. That's it.
Blown out of proportion, hasn't it, slightly?
Oh, big time. And there's this whole thing that's been going around on social media. Obviously, people like to kind of make their own comparisons and kind of label players similar to other players from an era gone by. And obviously, the nickname that Foden has kind of earned for himself, he's got two, hasn't he? He's got that Stockport Iniesta, and he's also got the skin fade Gascoigne. And I think people are so keen to put two and two together. Because Gazza, by the way, in Euro 96, had blonde hair, not silver hair. So I don't know why anyone thinks he looks anything like Paul Gascoigne, because he absolutely doesn't. They're also, I don't think they're that similar players, to be honest. But still, yeah, he's had a haircut, and who cares? It's not that big a deal, is it, to be honest? It's just one of those things where Classic needs something to talk about before the Euros. So let's big it up and say that, you know, Phil Foden's got his haircut to look like Paul Gascoigne, when actually I think Foden's come out himself and said he's had the same haircut his whole life and he just wanted to change it up a bit. So there's not really much more to be said for it, I don't think.
Yeah, very true. Ian, have you had any hair nightmares that you can throw into the mix that you can let us in on?
Yeah, well, I see my hair is relatively thin in terms of its diameter. I know hair is thin anyway, but mine's really thin. So it means I can do very little with it apart from put some wax on it. I've discovered this in later life, but you know, mid to late 90s, I did try to attempt to grow the curtains, which were a good fashionable haircut for many at the time, but not with my particular standard of hair. And as I did it, basically, it kind of stuck to my head and didn't grow very long, so it didn't kind of go out. There wasn't much volume, so I sort of looked a little bit like a 1920s vicar in a murder mystery. So it was not something I really want to repeat particularly. As for Phil Foden, though, I think that it's you know, he does look a bit like Gazza, and he's also I was reading a piece from him where he was talking about the haircut and saying it is kind of accidental, but you know, he's not gonna knock any comparisons with Gazza's haircut because he's a bit of a Gazza fan. But also is a nod to Eminem in there as well. He said the thing was that when Eminem was big in the charts, Phil Foden wasn't going to be born for 4 years. So even there, he's looking at Eminem as a bit of a retro star.
Same as Gazza. Wasn't Gazza retired when Phil Foden was born?
Oh yeah. Well, yeah, we would definitely have been. I'm just wondering if Phil Foden will, in later years, if we were to get into a time machine and zap forward to 2035, will he be phoning a local radio station suggesting he's heading to a local crime scene with chicken, a fishing rod and a dressing gown? That's the big question.
I've just remembered that in the 2002 World Cup, I had the David Beckham mohawk. And wow. I had the red spray paint as well in the top of it. Do you remember that?
Classic. Yeah.
The thing is, it is sort of a traditional thing, I think, though, with England players and with players of any nationality come a big tournament, you always get one who goes for it with the hair. And like you say, Beckham's done it, Wayne Rooney's done it in the past. You know, it is a bit of a thing, isn't it? You always get one that comes out with the haircut that gets the tongues wagging. And because there's nothing to talk about at this stage, the press go mad for it because it's just a little something, isn't it, to feed off.
Yeah, well, I remember Ronaldo did his fringe, didn't he, to stop everyone talking about whether he had a knee injury and going into the 2002 World Cup or something like that. So
he just had the bit at the front.
Yeah, left. He grew that dodgy fringe. Yeah, well, I say grew it. He cut everything else. Yeah.
I don't know whether this is true, but JP, remember JP said on a podcast a few months back that the reason Ronaldo got that haircut was because his kid was very small at home watching the Brazil team on TV, and his child couldn't distinguish between him and Roberto Carlos, so he had his hair cut in a mad fashion so that the child could figure out which one was him.
Wow. I wonder what's true. It's one of them like Chinese whispers kind of thing, isn't it? It gets changed over the years what the what the actual rule was. Anyway, maybe one day we'll get to interview Ronaldo, El Fenomeno, on Football Social Daily. That'll be
one of my favourite ever players. Oh,
that'd so be a good podcast. But yeah, let's move on. So I'm sort of looking at this as a little bit more of a serious note on the Foden thing. I know we've had our laughs about bad haircuts and all the rest of it, but on a slightly more serious note, I think everyone's loving this haircut, and there's been an outpouring of, oh, look how good Phil Foden is, and oh, isn't he a laugh, and all this. Is there anything more serious in this, Niall, about the difference between Foden having a haircut and someone like Paul Pogba having a haircut, and us saying, well, not us, but pundits saying, you know, oh, he's just concentrating on his hair again and all this. Yep.
Paul Pogba gets far, far more stick than Phil Foden does for changing his hair. And there's no way that anyone can tell me that that's not true. If you just type in Paul Pogba hair, articles come up on Google. I know that's the case now with Phil Foden because he's had a haircut, but people that have suggested in the media, and there are people that have done this, that Paul Pogba, his footballing ability is being detracted from because he's focusing on his haircut. That's absolute nonsense. And to be perfectly honest, it's just the haircut. And this annoys me because, you know, I understand people get annoyed about, I mean, you can get annoyed about these things. People can irritate you and annoy you irrationally. That's just human nature. But to say that someone isn't playing as well on the football pitch because they're concentrating on what their hair looks like, that's just absolute rubbish. I mean, to suggest that Paul Pogba doesn't play particularly well when he's had a haircut, I mean, I just think that's a load of rubbish. Jesse Lingard's another good example. Yeah, he's a bit of a man-child, Jesse Lingard. I mean, he's older than me. He's in his late 20s, and he still goes around dancing and singing and being a bit of a fool behind the scenes. But people love him for it, and that's his character, and that's who he is. You know, and he probably isn't going to change now if he hasn't changed already. And why should he? Because that doesn't detract from his ability on the football pitch. You know, if he wants to score a goal and celebrate like a Muppet, that's up to him. Like, that's totally up to him. And it doesn't detract from his ability playing football. So I do certainly think that there is more focus placed on certain players when they do change their appearance. And naturally, when you are a sort of a superstar in the game, I mean, David Beckham, we've already mentioned him. He's an excellent example, because everything David Beckham did almost became sort of culturally relevant. Whether that be the tattoos he got.
Dumb thing, wasn't it? Whatever he got, everyone else
absolutely,
got.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, whether that's just part of the part and parcel of being a player these days when you're in the public eye, then you know, there's an argument to be had for that. But to be honest, I just think that there is so much sort of hot air that's been made over the fact that Paul Pogba gets a haircut or whatever. I do think he is targeted for the way he looks sometimes. And I think that is something that certainly needs to be addressed.
Yeah, definitely agree with that. I just do wonder what Graeme Souness thinks of Foden's new haircut, to see if he has that same sort of outlook on things. But Ian, do you think there's anything sinister in this, or is it just a one-off thing and we won't make anything of it when Foden's hair goes back to a different colour or whatever?
Nah, I don't think there's anything sinister in it. I think as I sort of mentioned just before, that we're in a period where there's nothing to talk about, there's no matches happening, we're in that period between now and the weekend when things get underway, there's very little coming out of the training camps, no new news, footballer gets haircut, oh well, there's something to talk about, fills the column inches. People love the rock and roll side of football, and a friend of mine that I know that works in the, obviously I do these Speedway podcasts, and on the podcast that we did a few weeks ago, the guy's called Phil Lanning. Phil is a journalist for the Sun newspaper and has been for 20 years, and he was saying what makes the headlines, what they want, and what they want is sex, drugs and rock and roll. They don't want to know about what's happened in the match particularly. They don't want to know about the generic everyday happenings of football. They want to know the stuff that's different, that's going to get people talking. And what are we doing now? We're talking about his haircut, and that's the kind of thing that interests people. It's as simple as that, and that's what newspapers are interested in. If there's nothing happening on the pitch, there's nothing, no new action to talk about, no scandal, well, we'll dig a bit of scandal out of a bit of a haircut. It's as simple as that. There's just nothing else going on. Now, if there was something more exciting going on in the world of football, whatever that might be, you can be pretty sure that a new haircut would be much further down the pecking order. It's just that thing. It's just that right moment. And that's why haircuts regularly get talked about before tournaments, because there's no else going on. That's all it is. I don't think it's sinister. And I think some players perhaps have more of a reputation of being a bit more of a playboy, a bit more of a, you know, a bit more out there. Maybe Pogba's one of those. And so when you have that kind of lifestyle, perhaps, that of which you've become accustomed, then the haircut is going to get more focus than perhaps, say, Phil Foden's, who's a bit more of a surprise. And I think you've got to be a confident person, though, to firstly have that haircut and then take that haircut onto a pitch in front of millions on TV as well. So you've got to follow it up with a performance, and maybe it amplifies the performance having a haircut that's bright red and makes you easily identifiable. I don't know, it just makes you stand out. I think that's all it is, though. I don't think it's anything sinister. Yeah. I just think it's, you've got a load of journalists hanging around outside hotels with notes to talk about, and then footballer comes out with a new haircut and it's like, well, there's my job done for the day. See you tomorrow.
Well, we'll see if he can certainly make the impact that his hair has in the coming weeks when England kick off their campaign against Croatia on Sunday. But for me, nothing will ever beat the Romania team when they all dyed the hair peroxide blonde ahead of their first game. I think it was Euro 96? I think it might have been. And they all ended up looking like 11 M&Ms on the pitch. But that was something that maybe we'll go for next time. I'd love to see Harry Maguire and Harry Kane with a skin fade blonde peroxide outlook on things. But we'll move this on. I'm sick of talking about hair. So let's move this on to some actual football. And something that caught my eye yesterday from The Athletic was a report that Antonio Conte's move to Spurs was... Obviously, we all know it's gone down the pan, and Conte has decided he's not going to take over Spurs. But basically, this report said that Spurs players had, and quote, reservations over Antonio Conte, according to The Athletic. And one thing that was mooted was his extreme and demanding methods put off some of the players who, but you know, one player had spoken to, a lot of them have probably spoken to Christian Eriksen basically and said, what's he like? And he said, it's hard, it's demanding, it's intense, it's very physical, and he shouts a lot and all that. And Spurs players have gone, oh, that doesn't sound good. And basically, Niall, is it, where are they coming from with this? Because, you know, all I'm thinking is Spurs have won naff all in 14 years, and the guy comes in who's going to work them hard and get something out of it, or potentially, and they've all gone, whoa, we've dodged a bullet there. This guy won the Premier League with Victor Moses at right wing back. Like, he's a winner. This guy's a winner. And
yeah.
All of a sudden, the Spurs players are going, well, don't really fancy that guy. Like, he's won the Premier League, he's won Serie A. He's won all kinds of awards around the world, but Spurs players didn't fancy him.
Yeah, this is a really strange report, isn't it, from The Athletic? And it makes you try and figure out in your head which Spurs players are the ones that have kind of brought this to light, or at least brought this up to the powers that be at Tottenham. I think that it isn't quite what it seems on face value, in terms of Daniel Levy is basically the boss of Tottenham, and he'll be the one that makes the decision at the end of the day. And whether there are reasons as to why, or other reasons on top of that as to why Antonio Conte wasn't offered the job or isn't going to be taken on as the new Spurs manager, obviously will remain to be seen. And he gets the final say at the end of the day, Daniel Levy. So maybe he has listened to the players, and maybe he does have a close relationship to the players. But I'm just thinking now, which players are the ones that would have expressed a disinterest in having Antonio Conte as the manager? Because I'm looking at this squad, I've got it in front of me here, and there's not too many names that leap off the page in terms of, oh, they might be the one that's thrown a spanner in the works. If you're looking at the senior players, obviously Hugo Lloris, the goalkeeper, is the captain. Toby Alderweireld is an experienced centre-half. And then you've got, on top of that, it's Harry Kane, but I can't imagine he'll be someone who would say that sort of thing. Dele Alli's another. Eric Dier's another. So I'm just looking here at the players that they've got, and the players that you would think would be the ones that would be sort of brash enough and big enough to stand up and make a comment about the training methods and the training styles. But you're absolutely right, Marley. Beggars can't be choosers. And at the moment, Tottenham are beggars. They've not won in 14 years, as you say. Pretty embarrassing for them. You know, my club, Portsmouth, have won a trophy more recently than Tottenham. Wigan Athletic have won a trophy more recently than Tottenham. You know, they're just two clubs that are down in League One. So it's like, it's a pretty embarrassing situation that Tottenham Hotspur find themselves in terms of trying to be considered one of the elite clubs in England, of which they are, by the way. I'm not discrediting that. But certainly in terms of silverware and trophy cabinets, it's gathering dust. And they need to kind of put a stop to this monkey on the back of, you've never won a trophy. And if you're trying to bring in a winning manager, like they did in Jose Mourinho, and then they sacked him when he got them to a cup final. They sacked another manager, Maurizio Pochettino, and he got them to a cup final. And Antonio Conte is another top quality coach who will more than likely bring success to Tottenham Hotspur. I just wonder who these players are. And I don't want to point fingers and try and speculate and guess, but I think it's quite difficult to figure out which players are the ones that have stood up and said, no, we're not keen.
Ian, do you think this rather sums up the biggest problem Spurs have got? It's not winning. It's the fact that they seem to be scared to put in the work almost, and too happy to be mediocre and say, oh, it's, you know, it's a good job we didn't get him in, because, you know, we'd have had to work really hard. You know, do they have to do something different to win things and to progress as a club?
Well, yeah, they do. And I think I'd take Antonio Conte, because your other option, you know, I take it by that they're not going to be interested in Marcelo Bielsa, who is a lot harder working than Antonio Conte by all accounts. Murder ball for 56 minutes non-stop.
Yeah. As a Leeds United under 11s side,
I've just found out.
We'll tell you after this week.
Just picking all their organs up off the training pitch as we speak. I mean, it just shows, I think, that Spurs is in chaos. You've got the tail wagging the dog. That's the first red alarm that's going off in my mind. And perhaps they do need to work more. As you mentioned, they haven't actually won anything. And it's like saying, well, as if the Spurs players are all Galacticos who have won every title known to man and that can sit back and sort of decide who is going to take them on to greater success. Spurs have won nothing. The lack of silverware, remember, was even mocked by Dulux. When someone tweeted they can now paint their trophy cabinet, Dulux replied saying, don't be silly, surfaces need to be dust-free before painting. I don't understand where this invite to the Big Six comes from with Spurs. It just all comes out that there is an absolute arrogance about them. Because apart from cash, they last won a league title in 1961. That's the same year Gary Lineker was born, the same season. And look where Gary Lineker is now. They last won the FA Cup in 1991. And in that time, Virgil van Dijk has been born, gone to school, won a Premier League, a Champions League, three Scottish Championships, a Scottish League Cup, a Super Cup and a Club World Cup. Spurs last won a trophy in 2008, as you mentioned, 13 years ago. And since that time, while Spurs have won nothing, Conte's won one Italian second division title, four Serie A titles, three with Juventus and one with Inter as recently as last month, two Italian Super Cups, an FA Cup and a Premier League title. And yet Spurs players don't think he's the right man for the job. And as we've just done there with Virgil van Dijk and with Antonio Conte, you're judged on your silverware in years to come. When you look up how good is a person, a player or a team, it's what silverware's in the cabinet. And currently Spurs have got none. And you've got players there who might be sat in a fancy stadium acting all Billy Big Balls, but apart from one League Cup 13 years ago, Tottenham have won nothing. And most of those players haven't won anything either. So, yeah, they do need somebody to lead them on to something better.
I think there's some concerning quotes and comments coming out surrounding Tottenham Hotspur anyway, Marley, in sort of a wider context as well. I saw someone yesterday posting an article which suggested that their new stadium, the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, the best stadium in Europe, perhaps even in the world, cost £1 billion, was built as an NFL venue, was built purely with the American footballers in mind and not with the Premier League footballers in mind. And that Tottenham Hotspur are merely the lead tenants of the stadium. And basically, it was built with the viewpoint of the being the home of the NFL away from home, or the UK home, or the European home of the NFL. That was what it was built for, with that in mind. And apparently, several NFL bigwigs were involved in the consultation process in terms of the building of the stadium.
No, well, they were, definitely. That's not just a rumour, yeah.
That's quite staggering, isn't it? Don't you think? This is Tottenham Hotspur Football Club, a huge football club in this country, a historical football club, and one that doesn't think of its own fans first when building a new stadium. Very strange. Anyway, that's just for another day.
Well, the London are going to get an NFL team eventually. I think that's the thing in the next maybe 5 years or less, and they need a regular ground for that to be based on. So the NFL were heavily involved in that construction of the stadium from the point of view, because obviously there is an NFL pitch underneath the grass slides out of the Tottenham Stadium, and the NFL pitch is there. And the rumour is the Jacksonville Jaguars are going to move over and become the London Jaguars, and or something like that, and they'll be based there. So yeah, there is definitely a long-term view for the NFL to be heavily involved at that stadium. But yeah, it's going to be interesting. And by the way, there's an outside chance of Speedway, believe it or not, going into the Tottenham Stadium in years to come. So watch this space.
Yeah, it certainly feels like there's some strange decisions that have been made and looking like being made as well. So Spurs have got to get this next couple of years right, otherwise they could fall off the map quite severely. But we'll see. Maybe if there's an NFL team, maybe someone will win something at the London at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. It still winds me up that it's called the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium as well. They need to bloody name that thing. It's winding me up having to write it all the time, because it just sounds so poor. But you know, it'd probably be called the Daniel Levy will probably sell it to I don't know, Dulux or something, the Dulux Stadium or something, I don't know. But maybe the London Silly Nannies can win something, or whoever moves there in the NFL. But we'll have to see in the next few years. But let's leave it there for the first part of the podcast. When we come back, we'll be talking transfer rumours. There's a potentially huge signing coming into another part of London. But we'll talk about that after this. Welcome back to Football Social Daily. We've been talking about the absolute state that Spurs are in at the minute for the 100th time this season, it seems like. Even in the summer, they can't get away from the dodgy decisions that are affecting their outcome on everything. But we'll move it on to another part of London now, because there's been transfer rumours flying around in this weird period where one season's ended, but the summer of football hasn't quite kicked off yet. And the one thing that's attracting the main headlines is a certain Norwegian kid called Erling Haaland, who was always linked with Man City and possibly even Man United at times, Erling Haaland. But reports in the last couple of days, which do seem to carry some weight, suggest that he's being targeted by Chelsea. And the rumour is that it's around £170 million. However, the deal will be make-weighted by a part exchange with Tammy Abraham plus cash. Now, Niall, I'm not sure about you, but do you think... see, to me, this makes more sense than a lot of what I've seen so far, because no one's got the capital to just splooge it all on Erling Haaland in £170 million, for example, or £150, whatever it might be. Do you think... Tammy Abraham, what is he rated? Maybe 40 million? If you say to that, would you expect 100 million plus Tammy Abraham? That's 140 in total, and you get a ready-made replacement for Erling Haaland. Do you think that makes sense?
Yeah, I think we'll see a few of these this summer, Marley, these player plus cash deals. I think there's a few being talked up at Manchester City as well already, regarding a few Barcelona players, which I'm sure will gather some momentum as the summer rolls on. But yeah, Tammy Abraham plus cash, it's not a bad deal, is it? And they're going to need a lot of cash, Chelsea, to sign Erling Haaland. I think they do have plenty of it. I don't think Roman Abramovich is short of a few quid, that's for sure. So yeah, I think this is an interesting one. And if you look at the strikers that Chelsea have got, obviously they've got Timo Werner, Tammy Abraham and Olivier Giroud. And Giroud has just signed a new one-year contract extension, or Thomas Tuchel has opted to take up the extension in his contract. So he's there at least for another year. Michy Batshuayi was farmed out on loan to Crystal Palace, and you know, he was being kept out of the side by Christian Benteke by the end and wasn't really getting any games at all.
Didn't do anything, did he?
No, and I don't...
3 or 4 goals all season.
Absolutely, and I don't think he's got much of a future at Chelsea. Although, you know, under Antonio Conte, ironically, 2 or 3 years ago was when he played his best football. And then he ended up getting loaned out the next season anyway. So, Michy Batshuayi, I don't...
He's been at Dortmund.
Exactly. So there is a relationship there between Chelsea and Dortmund in terms of signing strikers. You're right. And Tammy Abraham isn't fancied by Thomas Tuchel at all. Wasn't even in the Champions League squad for the final to take on Manchester City just a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, Thomas Tuchel opted to put 2 goalkeepers on the bench. He put Willy Caballero, who's now just been released by Chelsea. He put him on the bench instead of Tammy Abraham. So surely Abraham must be questioning his future at Chelsea, especially considering he was getting in England squads as regularly as last season and was now nowhere near the selection for the Euros simply because he hasn't had enough game time. So certainly I think Tammy Abraham does have the quality and the ability to go over to the Bundesliga and score goals. And I don't see why this move wouldn't make sense. Erling Haaland to Chelsea, part exchange with Tammy Abraham to knock a bit of cash off the deal. Although my gut instinct tells me, and I've no inside information at all, but my gut instinct tells me that if I was Erling Haaland, I'd still want to sign for Manchester City over Chelsea. That might have changed now, though, because Chelsea won the Champions League. They look a dangerous proposition under Thomas Tuchel. Lots of people tipping them to be the sort of title contenders, the dark horse for next season. Whether that's tipped the scales in their favour in terms of this race for Erling Haaland, I don't know. But I think if I was the young lad, having seen my dad play for Manchester City, having sort of supported the club growing up and going to games with your old man, I still think that Manchester City would be Haaland's preferred destination. But Chelsea have certainly made a strong case, and this is a tempting offer, I think, for Dortmund if this is the case.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely seems like something. And Ian, it could be another case of a relatively young English talent going and flourishing in the Bundesliga. We've seen it with Sancho. We've seen it with Bellingham. Ademola Lookman's been out there. Damari Gray's at Hoffenheim right now. So could it be another smart career choice for him? Because Dortmund are in the Champions League every year. There's plenty of good players at that club. So does that make sense for him as well?
Yeah, I think he certainly needs to get himself out of Chelsea. He's not going anywhere, is he? Because if he was in favour, he'd be playing more regularly. We won't be having this conversation. And playing in Germany, as you mentioned, it's a decent place to go. Decent standard of football. And quite a few players have gone over there and flourished and done well. I was chatting with a friend of mine who's a Chelsea fan, actually, yesterday. And he's was quite wary of letting Tammy Abraham go because I think there's a general feeling that they don't give some of the younger players the chance. You know, they let them go further down the line, see them turning into a world beater, someone else, or even Chelsea themselves end up forking out a fortune to get them back. And look at some of the players that Chelsea saw no potential in, like Mo Salah, like Kevin De Bruyne, like Romelu Lukaku. They all were let go in the last few years by Chelsea and gone on to be some of the most successful players in the Premier League in Europe. I mean, Lukaku's just won the Inter title with Conte. And
that still stuns me, Ian, that Lukaku was never given a chance at Chelsea. He played something like 12 Premier League games. I mean, the man has scored over 100 Premier League goals. He's an absolute goal machine. I can't believe they never gave him a chance.
It just shows you, doesn't it? And they're far too trigger happy, I think, at Chelsea. They do seem to want instant success, and we saw that with Frank Lampard. They don't give anybody time, and same with players. You know, they're quick to get them out the door, and then they flourish and become, you know, the best player in the league. I mean, of course, not least Lord Patrick Bamford of Wetherby, who's gone on to achieve amazing things and wasn't given a chance at Chelsea. So. Yeah, I think there is that kind of wariness that, especially with Tammy Abraham having got to the England setup and all this, know that he's got some talent in there. There's certainly something in there, but he's just not getting the chance. And yeah, whether that's a European club in Germany like that, or somewhere else in you know, even in the Premier League where he's going to be more of a starter or whatever. But let's not forget as well that Erling Haaland, born in Leeds.
Maybe he'll fancy a bit of Bielsa ball in future. Who knows?
Well, they tried. They tried a few years ago. You know when Leeds were when Leeds tossed it away, and they were in the top two, and then at the last minute the wheels came off, and they ended up going out of the playoffs. That year, Leeds had a young Erling Haaland at the training ground, looking round, and it was all kind of apparently bubbling on that it could have been a possibility had Leeds got promoted that year, and they didn't, and Sheffield United did, and hey, the rest is history.
Well, you got there in the end, and I'm sure the destination is what it is. Maybe he might have flopped. I don't know. Who knows? Nah, probably not. Let's look at him. He's an absolute freak of a player. What a player! But we'll see if he comes to Chelsea in the future. Another thing I was looking at as well, actually, I was trying to work out how many players Chelsea had on loan. I think it's something like 33 players. Which is mental. So I'm looking at this 170 odd million pound, you know, quote or whatever it might be. So you're saying 40 million for Abraham, that knocks it down to about 130 ish. And then, I mean, look at some of the players that have got coming back this summer. So Batshuayi, we've mentioned, there's Tamui Bakayoko, who's up for sale.
He's terrible.
You might get 20 million for him if you're lucky. I think he had an all right season at Napoli, so they might fancy him. Ruben Loftus-Cheek, who's had more loans than Blockbuster and never done anything with him, he's a potential England international if he gets a move right, so that might be 10, 15 million. Ross Barkley's a similar situation. You've got Danny Drinkwater, who'll raise you £4.50. You've got Conor Gallagher, who came back from West Brom. He's been linked with another loan move, but you know, 15 million could take him to a permanent club. They've just sold Fikayo Tomori for 28 million. Ampadu coming back. David Zappacosta coming back. Then they've got
another shocker.
Yeah, I mean, awful players, but worth 10 million if you sell him to an Italian club, because they like him over there. Obviously, he's quite highly rated over there. But then you look at who they've got in the squad, and there's rumours about Ziyech leaving and Emerson Palmieri going as well. And all of a sudden, you think if you can have a fire sale and get rid of all them, you could maybe raise £100 million. And all of a sudden, the outlay on Erling Haaland becomes £35-40 million. So it's not that much money when you've got that many players that you can possibly sell. But obviously there's work to do for Chelsea. We'll see what they do in the summer, and we'll see how serious they are about this move. But see if they can upstage Manchester City, who are also in the transfer market and talking about doing serious things. I think Khaldoon, Chairman Khaldoon, was talking about adding a couple of players of real quality, which scares me, to be honest, because they absolutely walked away with the Premier League. I don't think they need any more quality, but they're going to get it anyway. And one of those players that they've been talking about, Niall, is Saul Niguez from Atletico Madrid. And they're talking about Bernardo Silva being a similar to the Abraham Haaland style deal, almost like a straight swap more, though. Can you see this happening? Do you think Bernardo is that unhappy that he would take his chances elsewhere?
I'm not sure, to be honest. Interestingly enough, Sam Lee, who's the Manchester City correspondent for The Athletic and regularly features on Football Social Daily, he's written a few articles on The Athletic about the sort of state of play in the dressing room at Manchester City. And even though they've just reached a Champions League final, they've just won a couple of trophies this season, including the Premier League, there is always dressing room politics, even in a successful dressing room. And it's up to managers and the top managers to sort that out. Pep Guardiola is no doubt one of those top managers. Bernardo Silva, I can't see him leaving Manchester City, to be honest. I really can't. And I find this really strange. I don't think Manchester City would sell Bernardo Silva. There's this whole talk that Manchester City need to reinvest and strengthen, and Khaldoon Al-Mubarak, the chairman of the CFG and Manchester City, he's spoken in interviews saying that the best time to strengthen is when you're on top. And Manchester City are no doubt on top of the Premier League right now. They've proven that with silverware this season. So whether the idea is to sell some players in order to fund better replacements, I'm not so sure. Obviously, part of CFG, the City Football Group, you've got New York City, you've got Melbourne City, and there's several other clubs across the world in which they have lots of decent players. And if they can sell a few of those, that will boost the funds to kind of fuel their flagship club, which is Manchester City. And if that means that they get a few extra quid to buy some reinforcements and strengthen the squad, then that might be the way they go. I just can't see Bernardo Silva leaving. I really rate Saul Niguez as well. I think he's a very good player. He's shown over seasons and seasons and seasons for Atletico Madrid, even though he's only 26 years old. He's been at Atletico for, what, 8 or 9 years now? And he's shown how effective he can be in both big games and just on a regular basis. He's a consistent performer, and those are the sort of players you want in any club. So, yeah, Niguez is a decent player. Whether he's someone who I can see Manchester City coming in for, I'm not too sure. I can't see Bernardo Silva leaving. I think it's all very interesting at Manchester City at the moment. There seems to be lots of players linked with moves away, and I don't know whether that's just typical transfer summer speculation or whether there's any legitimacy in any of them. But I'd be surprised, I'll be honest, I'd be surprised if Bernardo Silva leaves, because he's one of my favourite Manchester City players.
He's certainly a character, isn't he? And he's come along as well. I mean, I just put that that picture on social media of him drinking coffee in the Guard of Honour when Liverpool came to the Etihad. That was one of my favourite memories of anything anybody's ever done in the Guard of Honour, to be honest. But Ian, can you see this happening? Do you think it's Bernardo's time to call it a day? Because he wasn't quite at the level we've seen him in 2017, 2018, was he?
Yeah, and I think reading between the lines, I was looking at this last night, that it's not necessarily entirely about football, whether he's being played or not, or whether he's in favour at the club or not. It seems that Bernardo himself is fancying a move back to Spain just for personal reasons, really. He's not really getting on with living in Manchester, it seems. Finds it a little bit wet and gloomy. Maybe somebody should have advertised that to him before he got here. But so, yeah, it looks like, I think that's maybe more the thing, that he's got personal reasons for wanting to go back to Spain, which you can understand. You know, if he's got family and life there, and the weather's a bit better, then you can probably see his point, perhaps. But I don't think it's necessarily, from what I was reading about it yesterday, that it's not necessarily entirely down to performances or chances or whatever. I think he's quite happy on the footballing aspect of it, but maybe there's other reasons that he wants to go live somewhere else.
Well, that takes us on to a nice nice little next story, because another player who's not quite happy with the footballing reasons is Ainsley Maitland-Niles at Arsenal. Now, he spent last year on loan, part of last season on loan at West Brom, and he was basically wanting to push towards that England squad. And I think I almost forgot about this, that Ainsley Maitland-Niles was in the England squad not so long ago, like last season. And he's one of them players you almost forget about, but he's basically saying quite openly that he wants to know about his future with Arteta, see where he's rated, and he wants to move if he's not going to get games. Now, we've seen Joe Willock go away from Arsenal for 6 months and, you know, enhance his reputation massively at Newcastle. So is it something similar for Ainsley Maitland-Niles? Is it something that he needs to take control of now and say, you know, I need to think of me at this point in my career?
Yeah, I suppose so. You mentioned him being in the England squad. He shouldn't really have been in that England squad anyway. He's not that good. He's an okay player. He needs to make himself a good player. I don't really watch much West Brom, and I can't really remember Ainsley Maitland-Niles starring or standing out or, you know, being man of the match in any of the West Brom games that I did watch. Whether I'm being harsh on him, I don't know. I don't know enough about him, to be honest, but is he going to make it at Arsenal? Maybe. I mean, like you say, Joe Willock went out on loan and really did grab that opportunity with both hands, and now Arsenal will be looking at him after his time at Newcastle and saying he's someone who could make a difference for us next season. Do you get the same feeling with Ainsley Maitland-Niles? Personally, I don't. I think maybe he'd be better off sticking around at West Brom, maybe another loan in the Championship and trying to gain some experience that way. It is quite crazy that he's got an England cap, but I don't think that defines him as a player. I think I want to see more from him. I don't really know too much about him anyway. I don't even know what sort of style of player he is, but he's not someone I'd be desperately disappointed to lose if I was an Arsenal fan. There's plenty of young talent there. Mikel Arteta seems to have some sort of idea of what he wants to do with the young players. But obviously Ainsley Maitland-Niles, according to this report, isn't too sure on what his future is at Arsenal Football Club. Do Arsenal even know what their future is my question. So I can see why he's slightly frustrated, but he's played now a couple of seasons in the Premier League. He's played for England. So, you know, that is a decent achievement. I don't think he should have been in the England squad, but still, he's played for England. He can say that. He's played in the Premier League for West Brom. They went down. He's got some appearances for Arsenal under his belt. Maybe he does need to look at another loan next season and gain some experience, because he's not a particularly old guy, is he? He's still got plenty of years ahead of him in his career. So I'm not so sure what happens next for Ainsley Maitland-Niles. And to be honest, I think that he's not someone that I think is going to be the next big thing, sadly for him.
Well, we'll see what happens with Ainsley Maitland-Niles. One thing I would say about it is that he's got a higher reputation now than Joe Willock did before he came to Newcastle, because he was even more sort of unknown and unproven. But Maitland-Niles is certainly someone who I think needs just a fresh start. I think he's made a lot of talk about wanting to play central midfield for whoever he plays. So I think that was the main reason he went to West Brom, because Arsenal were trying to get him into the team at right back or right wing back or even left back at times, and he didn't really fancy it. So I think it's time for him to cut ties there at Arsenal and go and back yourself a little bit and, you know, be the guy in charge of your own career there. But we'll see what happens to him, because it certainly looks like he's on the lookout for a new club. But that leaves it there for part two. We'll be back after this. We'll be answering your questions on the Any Question Answered section of the podcast. We'll see you shortly. Welcome back to Football Social Daily. We're into the third and final part of the podcast, where, as usual on a Wednesday, we will be taking your questions. We've got three questions today that have all came in via the medium of social media. Ian, we'll start with one for you. Robert on Instagram says, should fans start cheering the knee from the moment it starts instead of waiting to hear these boos first? And we've talked quite a lot about the booing on this week's podcast and what we should do to combat the Muppets that boo it and whatever. But do you think this is a route for it? Just instantly start cheering and drowning people out, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, it could work. I'm sure that, you know, if it is a noisy minority, then a noisy majority should cancel that out. So I can see the thinking. I mean, it is crackers that we're even having this debate, that people are booing people who are, you know, protesting. And it's the people who are booing are certainly, in my experience of complaining about it, are the ones who are not affected by the stand that's been taken, and so therefore cannot speak on the subject. So why they're booing on it, I've got no idea. It's the biggest disrespect to the England players. People say it's political. It's not. It's just about racism. It's about not being a moron. And all it's doing is morons are just taking it and feeding the whole problem again. The fact that they're booing shows that they need to carry on doing it. So, yeah, we don't need your sort around here. Drown them out.
Drown them out with cheering, says Ian. Niall, do you agree? Because it did kind of happen a couple of times, you know, both the times against Austria and Romania. As soon as the boo started, to be fair to a few England fans, or, well, quite a lot of England fans, they did start cheering.
Yeah,
and they started clapping and, you know, were trying to drown them out and that kind of thing. Do you think that's the way to go?
Yeah, I don't see any harm in it. I mean, like I said a couple of days ago when we discussed this after it happened, one of the great things about living in this country is that you're able to express an opinion one way or the other. And sometimes there is no right or wrong answer, but like I said before, I think in this case, there is a right or wrong answer in terms of the fact that it's a misunderstanding. I think that the people that are booing for a reason that they think is there, which isn't actually there. It's an invisible reason almost, and it's about education and it's about getting through to these people. But certainly, if there are a majority of people who support the cause and support these footballers in what they're doing by taking a knee, which I think is the right way to go, and they feel that they want to cheer, then they should do that. Absolutely, they should do that. But again, it's up to people. If they don't want to cheer one way or they don't want to boo, then they don't have to do anything at all. But I certainly think that, you know, it's not going to be any harm to the cause. Cheering, clapping, showing your appreciation and your support for a cause, which I think is exceptionally important in modern society. But yeah, certainly cheering or clapping, taking the knee, it is not going to do the cause any harm whatsoever. So it's totally up to whatever people want to do. I think that if I was in the stadium, I'd probably applaud it as well.
Yep, fair enough. Okay, we'll move on to something which is more football based. Noah Reid has been in touch on Twitter, and he looks at the Euros in the next couple of days and says, who are your dark horses for the Euros this summer? Ian, is there anyone who you think should be we should keep an eye on as potential dark horses for this one?
Yeah, there's a couple. I think, well, we won't...
Are you going to say North Macedonia again?
No, I don't think it's North Macedonia's year. I think they're on a transitional year at the minute. I think England are actually dark horses, you know, because we've won nothing since 1966. Even Spurs have won stuff in that time. Home advantage is a massive thing in a tournament. And out of 20 World Cups that have happened, I know this is Euros, but just still a tournament. Out of 20 World Cups, the host nation has made at least the semi-finals 13 times. So home advantage is a massive thing. England are going to play all group games at Wembley, apart from a couple of knockout games. They could have one or two matches elsewhere in Europe, but that's all. The rest will be played at Wembley. And that's got to be a massive bonus because tickets have been allocated in this country in the most part, and it's going to be, for the most part, quite a big home and partisan crowd. So for that reason, England, we won't see as dark horses because obviously we think England are going to win every single tournament that they ever enter, and we managed to fluke it one year and therefore we're the greatest team of all time. But elsewhere in Europe, you know, they will be looking, thinking, you know, this could be England's year, potentially, with all that in our favour. I think Germany have got a good chance as well. I think they're on the way back. I think a lot of people are fancying them. I know, again, they don't seem to us to be an outsider, but they've had a bit of a transition and looking fairly strong again. So, but you know, aside of people like, say, Spain or Belgium, I think would be the obvious ones. But yeah, I think England could come up on the rails. And I say that sounds like I'm picking a favourite. It is to us, but everywhere else in the world thinks that we're probably a bit rubbish.
What do you think, Niall?
I've seen a few teams before the tournament, actually. I've watched a few of the pre-tournament friendlies. I watched Poland against Iceland last night. I thought Poland looked a little bit disjointed, but they've got some decent players. They've lost Arkadiusz Milik to a knee injury, so he won't be involved. I don't think Krzysztof Piątek's also playing, but they've got obviously Lewandowski, who is an exceptional player. Their defence and fullbacks looked pretty decent last night, Poland. So I don't know whether they'll do anything particularly, but I think the determination was certainly there from some of the players that I saw on offer last night. Also Austria, I thought that Austria were decent against England, and maybe if they can continue to be robust like that defensively and make it difficult for the tougher teams, and then pick something up at the other end, maybe they'll be the ones who might be able to spring something in the tournament. They always, much like Switzerland as well. Switzerland are another side that are always in the top 10 in terms of European nations, but they never really strike you as a team that's going to do much. So maybe it's time for one of those teams, because if you think back to Euro 2004, Greece were the winners of that tournament, almost remarkably, and they beat the Czech Republic, I think, didn't they, in the final? So two sides that you weren't expecting can sometimes happen in the Euros. For me, one I am going to keep a close eye on, I'm not sure how they got on against the Republic of Ireland last night, I didn't watch that friendly, but Hungary, they're in the group of death. They're in group F with Germany, Portugal and France. No one has given them a chance, but if they finish third and spring a surprise and manage to win any of those games, then they might actually go through as the best third place team, because of course that's how the qualification has been done this year for the last 16 for Euro 2020. So maybe Hungary's one to keep an eye on in that group of death. Can you imagine if they manage to qualify ahead of either of those three teams, or any of those three teams, Portugal, France or Germany? That would be some story. So yeah, I guess maybe rooting for the underdogs, Hungary, looking at group F.
I thought Hungary had smash Ireland last night, and they ended up drawing 0-0, so it didn't sound like a thriller there, but yeah, maybe they can spring something like Greece did in 2004. They beat Portugal in the final. Now, not Czech Republic was the quarter final, the semi final. Sorry, they beat in the semi final when Milan Baros ended up that tournament as top scorer, which was bizarre. But yeah, then they went and beat Portugal in the final with it was Karisteas, wasn't it? That header he had with just the moment of his life. Well, he looked like one of the best players in the world at that tournament and didn't really do much else. Didn't he come to the Premier League, didn't he, the Karisteas, at one point?
I've no idea, mate, to be honest. I just say I love that Czech Republic team with Nedved and Jan Koller and Poborský and Petr Cech in goal and Milan Baroš. It was a very, very good Czech Republic team. I'm a big fan of that side.
Yeah, they were good. They don't seem too good these days, but maybe they're another little dark horse that we can look at in the coming weeks. I've seen a lot of people back in Turkey as well as a potential dark horse. But one thing I'm looking at is I think Ukraine will be one of the potential dark horses, just because I think they're a little bit better than everyone thinks they are. I think Andriy Shevchenko is actually the manager at the minute, so they should have goals flowing through that team if he's anything to go by in his international record. But we'll see who stands out from the best of the rest type when the Euros kick off on Friday night. Last question. Angie on Instagram, one of the long-term fans of the podcast, she asked a couple of weeks ago now, so I'm going back a bit to ask about this. Which player, it's quite an interesting one, this. Which player from this season would you like to see become a pundit, or who would you think would make a good pundit? Basically, Ian, we're looking for footballers with character, which isn't always the easiest thing, is it? But someone who you would like to see in the studio, pundit studio.
Well, I'm going for, I think, you know, you look at Roy Keane, and he's very blunt with his opinions, and how do you go up a notch from Roy Keane would be my question, and that's the way that I'm looking at this, and I'm nominating Zlatan Ibrahimovic. I think he would be an absolute no-nonsense pundit, really telling it as it is. It'd make Roy Keane look like Gary Lineker.
Go on, Niall, who you go for?
Slightly less charismatic than Zlatan. I'm going to go for Connor Cody, actually. I think even though we've got enough Scousers in the punditry game at the moment, I think that the way Connor Cody's spoken in interviews when he's been put in front of the microphone as captain of Wolverhampton Wanderers, I think he's spoken very, very well. I think he understands the game well. I think he's a good character. I think he's got a little bit about him as well in terms of having a laugh. I mean, I think in terms of punditry, it's Micah Richards at the moment is the one that's kind of making everyone chuckle and bringing a bit of a breath of fresh air to the studio. Whether or not he's the most, best pundit, the best analyst out there is another matter, but he's certainly one that brings a smile to most people's faces. I think Connor Cody can do a bit of both. He's actually been in the Sky Sports studio before, and I thought he did very, very well, acquitted himself well. So that would be the one I'm tipping to have a future career in media, Connor Cody, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a good shout. Another one I would like to throw into the mix is James Maddison. I think James Maddison would be great. He seems very real. He seems very matter of fact and sort of says it out, says things how it is. I think he got a lot of plaudits for one of his post match interviews earlier this season. I can't remember who it was against, but he came out and said basically the answers that you wanted to hear and things about tactics that I saw. He was excellent. I'd love to see him in some sort of role. I think they roll out anyone for the Euros, don't they? They have such a big team that anyone gets the shout. So we'll see if anyone takes him up on that. But that'll wrap us up for today. We've been rambling on for an hour about everything from haircuts to dark horses to everything in between. So we'll leave it there for now. My thanks to you, Niall, and to you, Ian.
Cheers, Marley. Thanks, mate.
Cheers, thank you.
And we'll be back on Friday to look at the Euro 2020, which kicks off on Friday night with Italy against Turkey, one of the dark horses that I've mentioned. And we'll be back from Monday on every day as we are through the Premier League season. So we'll see you then, and join us then for another episode of Football Social Daily.